Fast Eddie for EAA Radio, talking to Frank Hildrop of the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board. Hello, Frank.
How's it going, Fast Eddie?
Oh, I can't complain at all. I understand that you are an accident investigator.
I've been with the NTSB for about 22 years. I was an accident investigator, kind of a frontline investigator for most of those years, up until about 3 years ago, and I took another slot involving more international aviation liaison work, advisor work, not only for our own folks, but working with foreign governments before, during, and after investigations that occur in the United States that involve foreign activities, but also a lot of activity overseas that we go and participate on.
So you've been on some fairly high-profile accidents then?
I've been on quite a few over the years. You know, luckily, recently, in the last few years, the major accidents we've had in the United States have been down quite a bit, and that's great. Overseas, we still have quite a bit of activity. I've done quite a few investigations over the years, the TWA investigation in 96, ValueJet. In fact, 1996 was a very busy year domestically and internationally, and certainly other accidents throughout those years leading up to now. Now, most of my work is working with our folks and other governments to help the process go the way it should go. One of the more notable accidents in the last couple of years was the Air France 447, and we've been active in that as well. And luckily, there's been a lot of progress by the French BEA, who's in charge of that investigation, and of course, we're working with them.
One of the aspects of Flight 447 was that they were looking for the black box. It was down in the ocean. It's a fairly deep water for, what, almost 2 years?
That's correct. I've done quite a few water recoveries and searches as part of my time at the safety board as well. Never anything that deep. I think the ones that were the deepest for me were in the range of, well, I take that back. Actually, one of my first ones was around 14,000 feet off the coast of Hawaii back in 1989. But that was not a recorded recovery. That was a cargo door had come off a 747, and so that was our main focus then. But as folks know, the flight recorders are hugely important to us, to investigators. And on the Air France 447, I think the depth of those recorders and the wreckage was in the range of around 13,000 feet. So
it was
not
pretty
easy.
Deep, as I recall. Now, the black boxes, they're not designed to withstand deep water for any serious length of time. But yet, there they were for out there for, I think it was like a year and a half, 2 years. What kind of condition were they in when you found them?
Well, it was almost 2 years, and I was not a part of the recorder readouts. We did have some folks that went over to the French BEA offices in Paris. And first off, when you get a recorder out of the water, you want to put it, you want to clean it, get the salt water out of any areas that could further corrode it once it gets into contact with air. So what we always do when we get recorders from the water, from the ocean, is to clean them with fresh water, distilled water if we can, and then place them back in water, immersed, until it gets to the laboratories, and then it can be dried out in a controlled environment. And in this case, all I can say is we got really good data on both recorders, the BEA, again, leading the investigation. But despite the time that they were in the water, the depth that they were in the water, the data was, for the most part, fully recovered.
Well, this is unlike the older mechanical flight data recorders that actually had a ribbon on it. This is a digital, solid-state electronic box, which there's no moving parts.
That's correct, and you made a good point, because the very first recorders that there were, going back quite a few years, was literally an aluminum foil recorder, and it actually etched the very few parameters it had, airspeed, altitude, heading, things of that nature. And then they moved into a digital tape you would see on a cassette tape of some kind. Still digital, but nowadays the standards are for changing most of these out, and to all the new installations are solid state computer chip of some kind. And they're obviously easier to maintain, and they're going to survive a little bit better too.
So let's just say that you're first on a scene of an accident and fires are out, the passengers are at the hospital getting taken care of and everything. What's the first thing that happens after all of the immediate emergency responses are taken care of?
With respect to something in the water, or
well,
just
let's say
a general
accident? Say it was a general accident. Somebody landed a little short.
Well, what we want to do, obviously, as you mentioned, we want to make sure the passengers and all the folks involved, it could be ground injuries, That's the priority for everyone, and we do not interrupt that process. We let the fire and rescue people do their job. And after that point, we'll start to secure the scene. Certainly, if there's an ongoing fire, we want to put that out. And once things are safe for everybody, including the investigators, we'll start to go through the different things that we will go through. And on a large-scale accident, we'll divide the investigation up into different groups. As the, it pertains to the airplane, we may have a structures group, a systems group, a power plants group, a cabin safety group to document the seats and how people evacuated the airplane, for instance. So that's, on a large-scale accident, that's how we'll begin that process. And each of those groups is chaired by an NTSB investigator, but we'll utilize expertise from some of the folks that know the airplane. If it's a Boeing aircraft, a specialist from Boeing, specialist from the airline that was involved, mechanics that understand and know the airplane, flight attendants, that kind of thing, that know the procedures and know the things that we need to know as part of the documentation process.
Let's take a rather famous example, Flight 1549, Miracle on the Hudson. How was the NTSB involved in that?
Nowadays, there's so much that's recorded. So I don't know when we saw this, but everybody, I think, and if we could see behind us, if we had a video camera here, you could see that being played behind us here, that being the landing on the water of the airplane. So that was important to us as well. But once we were notified, again, we assembled what we call the GO team. Anytime we have a big accident, even though the people survived, which is an amazing story, on a big air transport accident like this, we're going to assemble a large GO team to respond to an accident like this. As I mentioned, all those different groups, we're going to have weather, we're going to have air traffic control among the other groups, operations, and of course we're going to have the recorder groups as well once we get those recorders up. But that airplane, as you know, for the most part floated down the river a little bit, and we secured the airplane, towed it to shore where we could begin to do some of the things that we do. But again, we had surviving crew, which is not always what we have. We had a lot of information available to us, and that was a rather unique one and a happy ending in a lot of ways for everybody.
It was a wonderful ending. One crew injury to a flight attendant. One of the key things that you do with any kind of a major accident is recovery and reassembly of the aircraft. How do you figure out where all the pieces go?
Well, we have all worked on puzzles as kids, and that literally is what we do sometimes. And let me just back up for a minute, because it's not something that we need to do in every case. I think the situations that we would want to reassemble an airplane would be one where typically there's an event in flight. There's an in-flight fire where you start to see patterns that obviously you won't be able to observe or recognize once there's an impact and the fragmentation is substantial. So we want to get an idea of an in-flight breakup, an in-flight fire. It allows us to do is to look at the pieces. Some are burned, some are not. Some have more substantial damage, some less substantially damaged. And when a part comes off in flight, it loses a lot of its energy. So when it does hit the ground, it doesn't have so much damage as the rest of the airplane that's coming in with all that mass. So those are the types of situations that we may reconstruct an airplane in, but it literally takes thousands and thousands of hours with a lot of assistance. And again, let's go back to the assistance that we got from Boeing and the airline in the TWA 747 accident that I mentioned a little while ago. That was one of the most expensive, comprehensive investigations that we did. And that accident, again, 1996, we utilized a lot of assets over many years to help put the portion of the airplane together that we needed to look at. And that was really the area around the center wing fuel tank where evidence started to suggest fairly early on where the event initiated. But again, to get a complete picture, to try to figure out where the ignition started within the tank, which is almost impossible, we needed to start to reconstruct the airplane. So we did that in that case. Also in that year, I mentioned ValueJet. We reconstructed part of that airplane, too, because of the in-flight fire that was going on there. You can start to see the signatures. You can see it much more clearly with the reconstruction, literally like putting a puzzle together.
I was going to say, with TWA 800, which is the 747 that had the center fuel tank pop, how do you tell the difference between, say, an explosion on board versus an in-flight breakup?
Well, there can be some challenging signatures or perhaps similar, and it depends on the type of explosion, of course, too. A lot of times when we talk about explosions, we talk about high-order explosive that you might get from a bomb. That is entirely different than a something that a fuel air mixture explosion would be. But nevertheless, you'll get curling out of the metal.
You'll get a structural deformation.
You'll get a structural deformation, and depending on the type of explosion, you will get the metal to fold out. And I'll give you an example. If for instance, you see metal that were folded out opposite the direction of the airstream that it's experiencing, that would be suggestive of something like an explosive event, because typically what causes the peeling of metal, which can occur from just an in-flight structural breakup for other reasons, you'll see peeling of metal perhaps, but it's in the direction of the airstream moving across the airplane. So one example of a unique signature to an explosion, which again, extremely rare event.
Absolutely.
So I don't want to overstate that, but you'll see slightly different signatures. You'll see things that, again, that you would tend to see in flight versus ground impact. And that's a major thing that we're looking for. When we do these enough, we get an idea what airplanes look like when they hit with enough force from ground impact versus in flight type of damage.
It's amazing that you can do that. There's got to be a lot of voodoo going on back at the test lab to figure this stuff out. What kind of tools are you using to determine how an airplane breaks up?
We have some great people that work for the NTSB and great people that work for a lot of the parties that we call them, the Boeings, the airlines, the mechanics that understand intimately the airplanes. And we, in time, will understand enough about certain airplanes, but we rely greatly on the folks that help us do these investigations, because they know the airplane, they know the parts, they know what this part goes to this part of the airplane, where we're accident investigation managers. We may not know that intensely, but we rely on them quite heavily. And we also have metallurgists back in our lab. They will be able to tell, in some cases, the direction. When you see a tear of the metal, they can actually look at the details to figure out where that portion of the structure of that portion of the metal began to tear first. So a lot of times doing this, and a lot of good people make this work for us, and we do a pretty good job getting the answers that we need.
Undoubtedly, with Flight 800, you guys had a ton of people from Boeing working over. I believe they recovered, 85% of the aircraft?
I think the number is probably closer to 95%.
Staggering recovery considering the size of the airplane and the amount of area it was scattered over.
Exactly. And the one thing that was in our favor, one of the things that was in our favor, that is the depth of that recovery. On the order of perhaps 120 feet, it's diveable. It was fairly close to the Long Island coastline. Going back to the Air France event, I don't know how much they've recovered of that airplane. I don't know how much they're going to need to recover once they have the recorders and some good data from that. But certainly the depth of the water dictates a lot. Once you get beyond a diveable range, then you have to go to begin looking at underwater vehicles that have the claws, the things you may have seen in the Discovery type shows,
yeah,
or Titanic.
RPVs,
yeah,
and that
exactly.
Kind of stuff.
And I will say that in the Air France 447 investigation, they employed the use of some autonomous, untethered vehicles to help search a broader area more easily. And that was very successfully utilized in the Air France 447. Here we are, what's today? Today is July 30th. And only a few days ago, we had a 747 crash off the coast of Korea. Because it's a Boeing aircraft, under the international protocols, we are assisting with that investigation. It's a Korean investigation, but it's in the water as well. So we have to start thinking about how to find the wreckage, how to find the recorders, which have a little beacon on them. Every second, they send out a little ping, and that helps us locate them. And hopefully we'll be successful helping the Koreans with that. But that is something that just happened a couple of days ago. Our team is now on site in Korea to help with them. And again, that team involves the FAA and Boeing, but they're led by what we call an accredited representative from the United States, which means we're not in charge of the investigation, but we're there to help, because we have the responsibility of the airframe itself, the Boeing aircraft. And so we're there to lend assistance. If there are any issues about how the airplane performed, we want to know that, because that's how we bring information back to help the fleet, even on a foreign accident. So that's, in a nutshell, why we participate in overseas accidents, is because we still have the airworthiness responsibilities, the FAA does here, for our U.S. products. And we want to get that information to help the foreign authorities, but also to make sure that the fleets that we operate in this country incorporate any information that we may learn about.
You want to make sure that flying is as safe as possible.
Exactly, for everybody, not just in the United States, but anywhere. You got it.
Well, we're talking to Frank Hildrup here at the International Federal Pavilion. I'm Fast Eddie, and you're listening to EAA Radio.